Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I'm very happy to welcome my other co-hosts. First, he is the podcast editor for The Pop Break, as well as co-host of The TV Break on thepopbreak.com, Alex Marcus. Hello, Alex.
Hey, Justin. Really wondering what you needed me to do with this javelin. So if you could please tell me, that would be great.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the implication of that question of what divine power I might have. Yes. Oh, good stuff. Good stuff. Well, we are also very happy to have with us our other partner in crime here. He is the co-host of the Pod on the Rooftops podcast about the rock band Genesis with yours truly. Please welcome Noah France. Hello, Noah.
Podcast. And.
You are learning slowly but surely, and that's what makes you so endearing.
Noah, very smart. Like podcast. Okay, yes. I'll drop the bit now.
Well, if it's not entirely clear which movie we'll be talking about, we will be discussing The Suicide Squad later. And but we will be doing it with a very special guest. He is the editor-in-chief for thepopbreak.com, also the co-host of TV Break with Alex, co-host of the Socially Distanced podcast, where Alex actually appeared recently to discuss the movie that we'll be discussing on this podcast, The Suicide Squad. Hello, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm doing good on this bright and early morning. Yeah. But guys, did anyone check to see if the weasel can swim?
No,
right now.
No. He's an animal. Can't animals swim? Like, why do we need to check these things?
But he's a mutant animal, Alex. That messes with dog? The DNA. Dog, pig, loaf of bread.
Wow. So Mitchell's versus the machines joke that is excellent.
Yeah. I got still to
watch it, and it was worth it seeing it again.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll understand it a year from now when I finally see it.
I look forward to the day. And today Justin will be challenging Viola Davis, so the one and true Ice Queen.
Well, that's, I mean, can I just forfeit?
What, you don't want?
I don't have a heavy blunt object.
You don't want me to hit you in the head with a golf club, Justin? We discussed this.
Unfortunately, I'm not going golfing with whatever that senator was. I can't remember his name right now. Anyway, we are here, as we usually are on this podcast. We do a couple of different things on it. And the first thing we usually do is our full disclosure segment. This is where we talk about recent stuff we've been watching, whether it's movies, television, what have you. And then we do a featured review, which we will be doing on The Suicide Squad, as I mentioned before. And then, depending on circumstances, we sometimes will discuss a broader topic related to that film. Because we have four hosts, we'll probably just be talking about the movie. We'll probably have quite a lot to say, I imagine. But let's get into
Justin,
it.
Justin, I think the broader topic is clear. The true terror of polka dots.
Yes, in a way I never expected, knowing absolutely nothing about that character going into this movie. Didn't realize there was going to be a whole body horror thing attached to that character. Anyway, this will all be covered in good time, but let's start, guys, with our full disclosure segment and talk about recent stuff we've been watching. And Noah, since you've been champing at the bit the whole time, I want to start with you. What's been good for you lately?
Okay, so
what do you want to say to your big dumb friends?
No friends. All right, I'll stop now. This is going to get old fast. So other than this movie, what I've been watching recently is, as I've mentioned a couple times before, I am very, very, very slowly in bits and pieces going through a whole list of classic anime, Japanese anime series from the 80s, mostly from the 80s and 90s and early 2000s that have been recommended to me and I've just never gotten around to. A little while back, I finally watched Neon Genesis Evangelion, and Justin and I have an episode on that coming up. But what I want to talk about now is I'm finally I'm almost done. I have finally gotten around to watching Cowboy Bebop. Yes, I know this takes a hammer to the knees of my very real, very valuable street cred. I had not seen Cowboy Bebop until now. But it was one of the anime that had been recommended to me the most and that I'd heard about the most. And yes, it lives up to the hype. So what it is it's basically it's kind of like Outlaw Star, which is a show that I did watch as a kid and was a huge fan of. It's basically like a Western in space. There's a crew of very lovable misfit bounty hunters who sort of find their way together. And most of the show, pretty much like the majority of the show, is just them going on wacky hijink adventures and trying to catch bounties, usually failing spectacularly in some bizarre, hilarious way. So there's Spike, the main character. There's his burly ex-policeman friend and co-pilot with a cyborg arm, Jet. There's Mae Valentine, who's like the sexy seductress character with a shady past. And then there's a very young girl who's a super smart hacker genius named Radical Ed. And there's a corgi. The corgi is just as well known, just as beloved as the cast. And they go on these wacky hijinks. There's a little bit of what I like about it is it's one of those older anime series where you get bits and pieces about this world where humans have apparently colonized most of the solar system. And there's a whole system of gates and transportation means for humans to get to one planet and moon to the next. And you get a little bit of backstory about a catastrophe on Earth that led to this colonization. But only when it's necessary. You're focused on these characters having the adventures, but you feel like you're in this bigger lived-in world. So when outside elements come in, it feels very organic. And it's a fun, funny show. I'm really looking forward to getting to the end, and then I'm going to watch the movie. I think it's just called Cowboy Bebop, the movie, that concluded the series. Great soundtrack. That's another thing that I'd always heard. It has this great like jazz fusion soundtrack, and that's amazing. It's just great. It's exactly what, you know, what I imagined when I was told, okay, you know, this is a classic anime from the 90s. Like it's very much in that mold, and it's very much up my alley. So I've been having a lot of fun finally visiting it.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're watching it. I actually watched this for the first time, like myself, this past year. So
Justin,
I'm in the same.
Our cred is getting hammered today.
I know.
Oh man.
I know. I feel like I'm still a neophyte when it comes to anime in general, but I'm looking to catch up. And yeah, I really dug this series as well. I loved the I think it is like just in terms of world building, I think it is such a good job because it's all just presented to you in like the context of the situation. Like you just kind of figure out things as you go along. And
yeah. And it's only what's needed. You learn right. What you need to know for the plot of that episode.
And yet and it manages to tell you so much.
Yeah.
Right. In that time, just through the situation. And the characters, like you mentioned, are just so lovable in spite of themselves sometimes. And I love how
they're all lovable scamps.
And they're also distinct from one another. I mean, it's. When you get to the end of the series, I won't say too much, but you really do feel like there's somehow been this bond that's been cultivated over this time, even though very few times do they actually acknowledge it. And that feels truer to life, I think, in some ways. I'm a really big fan of this series. The last two episodes, I think, are just totally masterful. So I'm really excited to hear when you get there. You'll also have to let me know if you're able to find the movie, because I was not able to find it. And I like, it's the one thing I haven't seen. It doesn't appear to be streaming anywhere the last time I checked. So if you find it, let me know.
I'm not there yet. I mean, I guess I'm watching it on Hulu. So I assumed it would be on Hulu, but I guess not.
Yeah. I don't think so. I mean, that was where because that's where I watched the series as well. I know for our other two guests, are you, Alex and Bill, maybe I'll start with you, Bill. Are you familiar with this series?
Yeah, I'm very familiar. I've seen a handful of episodes in my time. It's a show that I wish I had gotten into when I was younger. No, I have never watched the whole thing from start to finish, but I've seen plenty of episodes of it. Very much enjoy it.
It does work. It's one of those shows that very much, it's one of those older shows that does work, as opposed to today where it's assumed that you're going to binge watch a series from the start. I do kind of like that about certain older shows where it's kind of, it's sort of designed in mind where most of the episodes you should just be able to sit down and watch it and not necessarily need the backstory, you know?
Yeah.
I've never seen the movie or the TV show. I mostly know this property as a headline of like that I've been tracking for the last like 15 years on like sites like slashfilm.com where they say that it may or may not be getting a television or film live action adaptation. That always
That's been on and off like for years. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's all I really know is just it's like an article will drop where they say so and so is thinking about developing a Cowboy Bebop movie and then everyone screams, no, don't, and then it doesn't happen. And that's pretty much all I know about it.
Well, I can assure you guys, if a live action adaptation is ever made, I will not watch it.
But I do have good news involving how you can watch the movie. It is not available to stream or rent or buy digitally, but if you wanted to buy it on Blu-ray, it's $11 on Amazon.com. And DVD, there's 17 DVDs left on Amazon for the price of $7.63. So.
Oh, my God.
All right, good to know.
and also probably worth consulting your local library, which may have it on the shelf. You can always find surprising finds in libraries when it comes to movies that are not available on streaming.
We at Cinema Joe's stan local libraries.
Isn't John Cho supposed to star in it, the Netflix series?
Is the live action Netflix series actually happening?
I know he was attached. I don't know what the status of it is as of this moment.
Yeah, I remember that was the big announcement. Everyone's like, this is actually a very good casting. So we'll see, I guess.
Oh, yeah. The most recent update is from June of this year saying that it is happening. So.
Yay!
John Cho attached to star. So we'll see how that goes. It'll be for Netflix.
I just looked up some of the casting. I don't recognize a lot of the names, but the one name other than John Cho that I recognize here is apparently Rachel House is in this.
Well, that's excellent.
Which is interesting.
She's always great.
Yeah.
I assume as my Valentine?
Yeah, it says that they finished shooting it, so I guess it is really happening.
No, she's playing... I don't know if she's playing a character from the series proper, because I think it looks like they might be... I don't know. We'll see. I don't know if they're doing the same kind of episodic structure that the animated version did.
Well, I mean, the last time I saw a Netflix live-action production of a Japanese anime was Death Note, so...
Oh. That was the thing that happened?
It's the only half-star review I've ever done on my blog.
Oh, boy.
The half-star was only for the casting of Willem Dafoe. That was a good choice, but okay. Everything else.
Willem Dafoe is never a bad choice. But yeah, I'm reading this news now, and it's saying that the live-action show is expected this fall, actually. So it might be coming sooner than we think.
Oh, boy, my timing is impeccable. I can rail against it in real time.
Maybe it'll be good.
Yeah, maybe I'll see the next Disney live action remake. Who knows?
Hey.
Stick it to your guts there. Well,
yeah, Bill, if you're not aware, Noah is infamously like a hater of any live action adaptation of an animated classic. So
he's got enough ammunition to back that up.
I will die on this hill. I am surrounded by the corpses of my enemies.
It's a very tall hill, then.
Yes.
Well, let's go on to our guest next and find out what he's been watching. Bill, what's been good for you recently?
for the sake of this podcast, I will spare everyone my talk about pro wrestling, but I will
this say is not the, weekly manga recap.
Well, it is. I will. I'm actually watching a documentary series on HBO Max right now. It's on HBO, but I'm just watching it on HBO Max right now. It's called 100 Foot Wave. It's about the surfer named Garrett McNamara, who found this random little town in Portugal and started surfing these monstrous skyscraper-sized waves. And it's besides being like aesthetically just like amazing, just how they put this film together and cobbling footage together from the mid-2000s, I'd say going back 10 years or 11 years ago, and also updating it. It's just such a gorgeous surf film. But unlike a lot of surf films out there, like, it doesn't get boring because it's not just like, hey, here's a wave. Hey, you know what? There's another wave. Look at that guy on that wave. Hey, there's another wave. And that's basically what it is. It's basically about this guy's kind of like his background and his motivation is somewhat sometimes obsession with riding these monster waves. And it's just a really cool story about like the desire to for accomplishment and just like the science behind surfing, as well as like the mindset of people who ride waves that are the size of, you know, buildings you would see in New York City. So it's a really cool documentary to check out. I think it airs Sundays on HBO, but I believe all this stuff's going right to HBO Max. So it's really cool. They're about hour long episodes each. Each one feels like a mini film in itself. So it's pretty cool. And I also I'll put this movie over because I don't know if anyone else likes it. But I watched Disney's Jungle Cruise, and I gotta tell you, it is a pure popcorn flick to like the absolute core. If you enjoyed, like, it's like, hey, did you like Pirates of the Caribbean? Cool. You'll like this. Did you enjoy The Mummy with Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz? You'll also enjoy this movie type deal. It's just a really big, fun film that doesn't take itself too seriously. Has a little bit of that, you know, typical like fantasy fantasy pop thing you would see in a Disney film like this. And while it does unravel a little bit in the third act, like The Rock and Emily Blunt really work well together. Jack Whitehall plays, he's a British comedian. He plays Emily Blunt's brother. I think that he adds a very well-needed comic relief. And this is just like, I wanted to see this, I didn't go in with the highest of expectations, because I've seen what happens when, you know, rides or certain properties get turned into films. And I have to say, this was, while not as overwhelmingly fun as the first Pirates movie, this was a heck of a lot of fun. So if you're not looking to spend $30 on Premier Access, wait a couple more weeks, let it go free to on Disney Plus, and then definitely check it out, because it's definitely worth your time.
Cool. So you would say that it is not as good as Pirates of the Caribbean, but better than Eddie Murphy's Haunted Mansion in terms of Disney ride movies.
Oh, I mean, yes. I mean, and they're actually doing another Haunted Mansion movie.
But of course, everyone knows that, I mean, there's only one real Haunted Mansion movie, and that's the one that Eddie Murphy did.
Yes, I would say it is leaps and bounds better than that one.
Okay.
Oh, that's good to know.
And now I have to ask, and please don't talk about it for very long if there's not much to say, but there was a bunch of, like, you know, conversation and expectation around this movie a few months ago, because it was revealed that Mr. Whitehall's character was going to be an openly gay character, but he's going to be openly gay in that he never refers to his sexuality explicitly, but is apparently gay anyway. And I'm just curious how that all plays in the movie, if it's like another example of LeFou from Beauty and the Beast, it's handled a bit better than that.
I think it's I didn't see that one, but I know about what happened there. This one was handled. It's basically what happens is The Rock, and because he'll always be The Rock to me, I'll never be Dwayne Johnson. Their characters are sitting, like, they're just like, Emily Blunt's doing something. They're just talking about her. And then he essentially starts talking about, Jack Whitehall's character starts talking about how, because I think The Rock's Rock asked him, he's like, why are you here? You obviously don't want to be here. And he's just like, well, I'll go. And it's his, basically he starts talking about how Emily Blunt's character has basically protected him when no one else would, because obviously he's talking about basically inferring that he's gay. It's like just say, he's saying without saying it. And he's like, I've been, so he said, let's just say I've been engaged 3 times to very nice women, and my interests lie elsewhere. And because of those interests, everyone has cast me out. And the only person who's ever come to my aid and who's ever defended me and still loved me despite my interests going elsewhere is my sister. So he's like, I don't care what adventure she's going to go on. She's had my back. I have hers. And it comes up and you just see like Dwayne Johnson's character. Well, I just call him Dwayne Johnson. Just blew my own theory there. this is what happens when I don't have caffeine in the morning. I lose all my principles. So if you ever guys ever need me to compromise myself, just wake me up and don't give me any caffeine for an hour. Here we go.
Got it. So anyway, if I ever need to rob a bank with you, I'll schedule it for like
what's,
6 days.
What's your credit?
So tired, I'd be like, all right.
So what's your credit card number again?
but they so yeah, and then the Rock's character goes, he just looks at him, he goes, to, you know, basically accepts him by saying to other interests, like, and like saying like, hey, it's cool. And like, cause, and I thought it was actually a pretty good scene. Like it was like, for me at least, it's just like how he's talking, but he putting in the context of the time, he just wouldn't come out and say it. Probably he's trying to hide it, but like playing off that old like timey trope of like, here's the obviously gay character who just is being used for comic relief. And we never give him more of a dimension than that. And I thought they gave him a good dimension there. They gave him a little bit, they gave him something like more of an emotional beat there. And I thought it was a pretty cool moment. And then having the Rock's character basically be like, hey, you're cool. Like everything's good. Like I thought that was a nice little moment. It wasn't just like, oh, they accidentally smooched for a second. Controversy. Look how daring they are, you know? Like yeah,
and no. Also, it wasn't the director of the film in a support group mentioning the fact that he went on a date with the boy.
I thought it was done well. Others may disagree, but I thought it was not just like this. Like I didn't think it was just like a pandering or just moment or something like that. I thought it gave a character a nice bit of dimension. And then again, I'll spare you guys wrestling talk. So those are the two big things that I've really been into. But I'm going to actually start Heels on Stars tonight, which we're recording on Sunday. So that premieres. It's the Stephen Amell wrestling series that's premiering on Stars, which thepopbreak.com has interviews with the entire cast. So check that out.
Wow.
Yep.
And TV Break will be covering it next month in our September episode.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate you. appreciate you taking one for the team there.
All right, well, that's I heard, like, I was maybe, if there was any interest I had in Jungle Cruise, it was purely for Emily Blunt. But
who's,
you know,
great.
It's
she's great in it.
Yeah, that's, yeah, no surprise. But yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know about that other angle. But let's go on to one of our other co-hosts, Alex, and find out what he's been watching recently.
Yeah, so I just last night I had the opportunity to watch a movie that is exclusive to Apple TV Plus, unfortunately, because I feel like whenever I watch one of these movies, I'm like, hey, this is really good. Everybody's like, cool. I have no idea if I have that or how to get it. And so I will politely listen to your feedback and never watch this thing. So that always stinks. But if you, like many people, signed up for Apple TV Plus to watch Ted Lasso, stick around to watch a movie called Coda, which is directed and written by Cian Heder. I'm not sure. I haven't heard it pronounced out loud. So I apologize if I got that wrong. They're most known for being a writer on Orange is the New Black and Little America. They also directed and wrote a film a few years ago called Cholula, which I think, Justin, you saw, right?
I did, yes. I really enjoyed it, although a lot of that probably had to do with the chemistry between Elliot Page and Allison Janney. And it's a really fun kind of hangout movie. So yeah,
well,
definitely a fan.
If you like great chemistry between older and younger actors, then I've got news for you. Coda is excellent, and definitely in your wheelhouse, because it stars a very talented young actor named Amelia Jones, who I had never seen before. She's apparently one of the stars of Netflix's Lock and Key, but that's a show that I have not seen. And her other credits, she's been in a couple of other things in very small roles. Like, for instance, if you saw the 2015 movie Youth, you might remember her as Pale Teenager. So, you know, she's been in that kind of lane for a while.
The credited name for that character?
I starred in that role for a number of years as well.
But, Pale Teenager.
Yeah, I think I still technically could get cast in that role.
I'm Spartacus.
But anyway, so this is kind of her big a big break for her, because she has to spend so much of her time opposite Academy Award winner Marlee Matlin, because they play mother and daughter in this movie. Again, it's called Coda. That is an abbreviation for Child of Deaf Adults. And that's because Amelia Jones's Ruby character is the only hearing family member of a family of deaf fishermen in a very kind of small, rundown town in New England. And it's sort of about her experience her experience kind of balancing the obligations she has to her family as the only hearing person. She obviously has played a very functional role for them throughout their lives, being able to help interpret what other people are saying to them, help be their interpreter at restaurants and doctor's appointments and things like that, and from a very, very young age. And also trying to balance that with her burgeoning love of music and singing, which she always has loved, but only in her last year of high school has decided to kind of explore through joining the choir and potentially thinking about a music school at college in her future. And of course, there is the dramatic irony of the fact that her greatest love and her incredible talent is something that her family cannot witness firsthand and truly appreciate, because they, of course, cannot hear her singing. So they don't have any real reference for whether she's good or if this is a fruitful path for her. And they can't really share in the beauty in it in the way that she can. So it's this sort of interesting tension between her and her family. That might make this sound very sort of tense and upsetting, and that really is not the case. This is a movie that is filled with love, and it is very, very smart in how it observes small moments with inside families. It tries to cover the highs and the lows with a broadly heartfelt approach, and I think that it really hits that very well. It was the grand jury winner and audience winner at Sundance this past year, and it definitely feels like a Sundance-y movie. People have said that, and I think rightfully so. It has a lot of those kind of coming of age indie cliches that you would expect from a movie like this, and I think that is something that holds it back a little bit for me. It feels a little bit overly loaded with plot contrivances that help kind of ratchet up the stakes and make everything seem kind of the end of the world in a way that I feel like if they kind of just relaxed and trusted the fact that their premise was really interesting and had a little, let it breathe a little bit more, I think it would have been an even more successful film. But as it is, it's really nice. It's very heartfelt. It's got a lot of funny moments. It has some sad moments. It has some transcendent moments where people really experience the power of music in a way that I think could be really corny, but they really sell it. And Marlee Matlin and Amelia Jones play, as I said, mother and daughter, and they have such a wonderful, real feeling relationship inside of a context that could be filled with a lot of tropes. And I just really loved it. The other two members of the family, the father is played by Troy Kotsur, and the son, who the adult son, I should say, who's like kind of like in his like early 20s, it seems, is played by Daniel Durant. And they are both also really excellent. All of the deaf the deaf roles are played by deaf actors, which I think really brings a lot of authenticity to the film. There's a lot of scenes of people yelling in sign language, and you might feel like that could get tedious, but it actually really is effective, and I think really helps you get inside of what their world is like, and what their family dynamics are, which is really at the heart of the film. So I did really like this movie. It also features this sort of like I guess the most polite way of putting it is sort of a magical ethnic music teacher who may or may not be queer, despite having a wife and a child.
Okay.
And he kind of like, you know, imparts the wisdom of the arts to this girl and gives her the confidence she needs to, you know, explore the world. And that stuff, like the actor is doing a good job, but the role is just so hacky and it kind of makes me cringe sometimes. You can't have a coming of age story without a magical ethnic character to teach your white protagonist the importance of living their authentic self, I guess. So
is
I guess
that was that a thing to is include. Is that true? Do we really need that?
I don't. This movie certainly seemed like it did.
Necessary?
But it's really good. There's also some stuff in here about like the fishing community and various forms of discrimination that this family has to undergo. And again, it tries to handle these things seriously, but not in a very kind of gritty and dark sort of way. It tries to hit that tone of heartfelt first, you know, like a kind of everything is like we go through hard times, but everything at the end of the day is good. I watched this right after the most recent episode of Ted Lasso, and I feel like that was a kind of nice pairing that Apple is pushing right now. I think that the two tones are somewhat similar. Ted Lasso is a bit more broadly comedic, but yeah, it's a really good movie, and I think that it's gotten hit for being a bit too filled with cliches, and I can't argue with that. I just think it just works. The part that works for me enough to overcome some of those drawbacks.
Everyone I know who's seen this film so far, like you, Alex, is just like an immediate, like, you need to watch this movie. Go find this movie. And for such a small movie, like, Apple TV, Apple TV is still one of the, you know, it's not the top streamer, so it's not getting as much exposure, but like, anyone who I know who's seen it is like super excited about it and really is trying to get as many people as they know to watch. And there's like four or five people I know who've done that. So I'm just like, it's capturing a lot of people whose film tastes I very much appreciate. So I would definitely try and check that out.
Yeah, and it's like if you go into it thinking like, oh, this movie won Sundance and it's one of the best movies of the year, blah blah blah, like your expectations might be a little bit too high and the movie might suffer. But I think if you go into it thinking about it as just like a nice heartfelt family dramedy about like exploring a unique perspective about how important art is to the human condition, I think that you're gonna get a lot out of it.
Yeah, I've definitely heard a lot of good things about it. I feel like most of what I remember hearing about it was from a podcast that you and I, Alex, listened to, Little Gold Men. I feel like Katie Rich brings it up every episode, seemingly, as like, this is going to be the feel-good movie that makes us just feel better about life. And I'm like, yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah, I mean, that might not necessarily be the best thing for this movie, because that's certainly the aim I think that it's going for, but that also might make you resent it a little bit if you're just like, don't try to like manipulate me into feeling good about things movie, yeah. You know, because there is, I mean, no spoilers, but they kind of stack the deck pretty high in terms of plot developments. And then there's a bit of an easy sort of resolution that you kind of can see coming a mile away. And I could see that rubbing some people the wrong way, but I think you just have to go with it because that's just the kind of movie that it is. And I think that if you can, you'll get a lot out of it.
Well, I definitely look forward to checking it out.
Justin, what have you been watching lately?
So I watched a film that I know at least my other co-hosts have seen. I don't know if you've seen this yet, Bill, or if you're interested in seeing it, but I saw The Green Knight, which we talked about.
100% like has been my number one movie of the summer for like a year.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a while. Like, it was announced a long, it seems like, you know, at least 5 years ago, but at least that's how it seems to me.
What is time, guys?
But yeah, I got a chance
funnily
to see
enough,
this.
That's the theme of the film. What is time, even?
Yes, to a certain extent, yeah.
sort of, yeah.
So yeah, this is from David Lowery. This is written and directed by him, who did such films as Pete's Dragon and A Ghost Story, which I know a lot of us are big fans of.
Oh yeah.
The Green Knight, as I mentioned in our summer movie preview, was definitely one of my most anticipated films of the year. This is a retelling of I thought it was always Gawain, but I think in the film they say like Gawain.
Gawain is how they pronounce it in the film, yeah.
I think with a lot of Arthurian names, you can kind of make it up as you go along.
Yep, that's how they work.
Using a hard and fast rule there.
But like I said, this is a retelling of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, maybe the most famous medieval poem outside of maybe the Canterbury Tales. And this involves a Knight of the Round Table going on a fantastical quest. And for a film that, was maybe my most anticipated film of the year, I would say I was kind of like mixed to positive on it. It is maybe a different film than I was expecting in some ways. It almost feels, and I don't know how it was with you guys, but for me, it almost felt like watching a sort of hypothetical film as opposed to watching the film proper. And it almost felt to me like that was kind of by design. There's a lot of talk in this movie about playing games and about how you always have to remember that it's a game. And I couldn't help but feel that way kind of about the movie of like, you know, this is almost like this situation that's almost like a thought experiment or something, except it's all visual and it's over 2 hours long. And it's like we don't learn a lot about this world. It's mostly presented through images, I would say, more than anything else. And I'd also say it's presented almost like at arm's length. Just to give you an idea of that, this is a film that is about Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, and those names are barely brought up at all, if at all. You know, it's not clear to me who's meant to be Lancelot or Galahad or Hector or any of the more famous Knights of the Round Table. They're all
I think it is clear who's supposed to be Merlin, but only because the way he's framed.
There's like an old guy with a beard who at one point is like, oh, and that's it. He doesn't get any.
He gets a very significant. He gets to look very significantly at King Arthur.
I did not know that was supposed to be Merlin, though, I'll be honest. I thought this was about a different kingdom where this Gawain character played a role. I didn't realize that when we were talking about authorial legends, that like literally this was King Arthur and his court. I did not realize that.
But yeah, this is, like I said, it's incredible to look at. There's some amazing imagery here. Some of it, like, sometimes it's just down to like that rocky, muddy landscape that it seems like Gawain is trekking across for long stretches of this movie, which is a very different setting than you're used to seeing for this kind of thing. And
this goes hard on the English aesthetic of bitter, cold, foggy, and wet.
Yeah. And that's not to say there aren't more, you know, supernatural elements.
Bangers and mash and mud. Lots of mud.
And, you know, some really, I think, very stirring supernatural imagery. There's a ghost that definitely, like, gave me the creeps for a little bit. And it's not, you know, it wasn't the kind of bedsheet on the, over the, you know, kind of thing from
sequence,
Ghost Story.
That whole sequence evoked very uncomfortable memories of seeing Hereditary in theaters.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, well, it does, you know, there's a lot of beheading stuff in this film, so that makes sense.
Yeah, and it was played by, that ghost was played by Aaron Kellerman, who many people might know from a main role in The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, where she played a character whose plotline was basically cut out of the show because of pandemic reasons, and so it was very confused, and she tried her best to do a really good job, and the show really didn't serve her. Weirdly, I feel like she got like 3 minutes in this movie, and it was just way better experience.
Who was she in Falcon and the Winter Soldier?
She was what's her face, the like main terrorist of the.
Oh, what's her face? She was Callie Morgenthau.
What's her face? Bin Laden.
Yeah, Carrie Morgenthau. That's right.
Yeah. Didn't realize she was going to be in this before I saw it, so that was a pleasant surprise. And I do feel like this film is asking some really interesting questions, like what does it take to achieve greatness? What does greatness even look like? Does it even exist? and it's deconstructing all these notions of valor and chivalry. I think it's really fascinating how Gawain is like not a particularly savvy knight and is like waylaid by a couple of punks pretty early in this movie. And the way that Dev Patel, who plays Gawain in this film, which I just love, you know, I love a lot of the choices he's been making recently and the fact that he's been cast in a lot of these really interesting films. But the way that he plays it, it's almost like he's trying to ape some like old standards about knighthood he never really even possibly believed in the first place. Like, it's almost like he's like, yeah, I guess this is the thing to do. And that's a really interesting space to be in for a film that is about, you know, a knight on a quest that is supposed to give him all this glory and an honor. There's one shot I did want to talk about, which, you know, I guess a little bit showy, but it's just kind of stuck in my head these last few days since I've seen it. It's the scene where Gawain is riding out from the castle, and there are a bunch of, you know, on this ostensibly, you know, noble quest, and a bunch of these children from Camelot or wherever it's supposed to be are following him and like bidding him goodbye. And this scene just goes on and on to the point where they just kind of like start to lose interest a little bit. And Gawain himself is just kind of on this horse, you know, just kind of trudging forward. And you just hear the steady clop clop of the horse's hooves. And it's almost like I was thinking about that scene, like, you know, for this kind of story, usually you would just cut, like, after, you know, the children wouldn't goodbye, like, oh, isn't that a charming moment? And here he just kind of lets it keep going and letting play out almost like the way it would in real life. And I just think that gives you maybe a microcosm of what this film is at least in part trying to do, trying to take the glory and the romance out of this, almost trying to bring it into this more grounded space. I appreciate a lot about what it's trying to do. I will say there are moments in this film, it's a lot of different incidents. There are points where I did feel my interest starting to wane a little bit. I also, and I don't know how you guys feel about this. Maybe I'll ask you when I put it to you guys and how you guys felt about it. But I did feel like I kind of wish I'd been watching this with subtitles, because there are moments where I just could not hear the dialogue. Some of it is like put through a filter. Maybe this is just a problem I have in general with movies.
I think it's the maybe it's I'm losing English my hearing. Fog, Justin.
Yeah.
The sound equipment.
It could have also been the theater that you were watching in.
It's possible.
The sound mixes are not always well executed in theaters.
Yeah. I have to say when the trailers were running, when we saw our screening, the audio for the trailers sounded off. It ended up being fine for the movie, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But just in general, like, I appreciate a lot what this film is trying to do. I would recommend it to people. I will say I didn't have the same like unabashed love that I had for something like A Ghost Story. But, you know, I still kind of think I thought it was pretty, you know, it was unpredictable in a lot of ways. And I might actually make some time to see it again, kind of now that I have an idea of the kind of film that it is. But what did you guys think?
No one chugged a chocolate pie, so 0 out of 5 stars. I would not recommend. No, it was great. I loved it. I dug the hell out of it. I especially like the fact that it very much leans into the fact that when you really look at, I mean, this goes for a lot of myths and legends, but especially for Arthurian myth, which, you know, tends to kind of get dressed up a bit in, you know, bells and whistles and pretty dresses and, oh, it was a golden age. There's a lot of weird shit in Arthurian legend, and it tends to just come out of nowhere. It's like, oh, wow, there's a castle here in the middle of nowhere. How does that work economically? It just is, and the castle is filled with mist for some reason, and the knight has to walk through the mist and rescue a naked woman. Just sort of stuff that just kind of happens solely so that a knight can come up and do knight things. And the movie very much leans into it. It's just like, oh, there's something insane. Oh, yeah, of course there are like a bunch of giants that wander the earth, apparently, and sing crooning strange songs. It just happens. Here it is. And now we're going to move on. I really appreciated the fact that the movie got weird, and it was happy to be weird and to stick with being weird and did not bother to explain to you we're weird for this or this reason. It's just very strange.
Yeah, there's definitely a strangeness to it that is interesting. Justin, I think it's so smart you identifying that one scene as being sort of a microcosm of the film as a whole, the scene with the kids and him running away from them on the horse, because that scene is just incredibly deflating, and I feel like this whole film is extremely deflating, and I do think that that is purposeful, but I don't think that's always a very enjoyable experience, I guess, you know. I think that like the imagery of it is really just breathtaking at times, really evocative, some like visuals you just will never forget, but I also think that the pace is just incredibly leaden, and it was a kind of tough to get through for me, honestly, and that was a little bit of a letdown, because you know, the trailer makes it seem so like exciting, and this movie is anything but exciting. And I do think that that is intentional, but that again doesn't make for the best experience. Also, I don't know why they had to give Alicia Vikander two roles in this movie. That really confused me for a long time. I was like, what is going on? Is that actually a different person, or is that did they just cast in? Because you know, there's a lot of British women who can sometimes look similar, especially nowadays in Hollywood. So I was like, is it just two women who look close? And then it's like, no, it wasn't. It was a different, but like, was that intentional? Or I'm sure he was saying something there, but I don't know. So, and yeah, there's a lot going on. Joel Edgerton is, by the way, in this movie, and I typically don't like him in things. I usually find his performances to be aggressively bland and annoying, and I actually really liked him.
Well, we had a whole discussion about him when we did the Henry movie a while back.
Yeah, where he's bad in it. But he's good here as the Lord, and I found that character very interesting, honestly more interesting than the Alicia Vikander screen partner most of the time. But yeah, I don't know, I would actually not necessarily recommend this movie to everyone. I don't think that a lot of people who maybe would have been excited about it based on the trailer would actually enjoy it that much. But I think that if you are really interested in it, you should go and see it for yourself. But I would have, you know, temper your expectations a little bit. It's not necessarily the indie hit of the year that you might have been expecting, given this huge buildup. You know, I do think that Dev Patel is excellent, and I think that he really plays this sort of like very fallible character very effectively. And we haven't spoken at all about the Fox, but the Fox is pretty great. I like the Fox a lot. More Fox would have done this movie well. Maybe that makes me super basic, but it is.
Well, I know about Fox. Your love of animal actors.
Yes.
Soon, I hope we dive into this so the guys can really find out your love of rodents.
we definitely will. And I just also want a quick shout out Kate Dickey, who I guess is just professionally obligated to play medieval queens as often as possible, but she's really good in that, in a very small role.
I would agree with you, Alex. It is definitely, it is very much a certain type of film. It's not a film that you could just necessarily broadly recommend and assume that everyone could kind of get into the film's wavelength. I got into the film's wavelength. My wife did not. She was not a fan. She was very angry when we
not surprised. Not surprised at all.
So, but it's the more I think about it, the more it does stick with me. And the ending especially really did work for me. So it's definitely going to be up there in terms of my list this year. It's certainly only appreciated the more I thought about it.
Yeah. Remember when they spend like 10 minutes being like, why is he called the Green Knight? It's like, he's a fucking tree. Why else would he, what else would he be called? I don't know. I was frustrated by this movie sometimes.
That's funny. That scene almost felt to me like David Lowery had just transposed a discussion from a symposium about the Green Knight. Why is he green? Like, you know, just this whole thing.
It was an insight into the Iowa workshop, you know,
for yeah. I don't know if any of this makes you want to see it more or less, Bill, but
I didn't want to get spoiled by much, so I went and made myself a tea. So I missed a bunch because I was just like, well, I'm sure there's very intricate plot points that are being discussed, so I'm just gonna go.
Well, no, we're
yeah,
Well, we kept it pretty light on spoilers.
Yeah.
Oh, but half caffeinated Bill is now going to say that no, it's still like, listen, Arthurian legends sometimes. I mean, I don't know if we want to get in a full blown discussion about the Excalibur movie from the 80s, and wow, that's a thing.
That'd be a pretty short discussion.
Yeah, it's not great. Don't ever.
Well, I was just gonna say, because I don't think the three of us apart from you have seen it.
So. Yeah, you know what? Good. Don't. It's like, unless you want to see random cameos from a very, very, very young Patrick Stewart. That's
I'm always here for a cameo from young Patrick Stewart.
Are you trying to tempt me?
On YouTube and find it and spare yourself that, because he used to be on like basic cable all the time, like TNT would show it all the time, and it was like a 3-hour movie, like, or four, like, you know, because they would edit it with all the commercials. So one day I was like, I'm gonna watch this, it's on all the time. My dad came in the room, he's like, how's this movie? I'm like, I committed to it, I just have to get my way, I just have to see it till the end. He's like, wow, that is the worst review of a movie I've ever heard, I'm gonna leave. And I'm like, yep, that's pretty much what it is. So, but yeah, Arthurian movies always, like, I don't know, they always seem to have a lot of complication to them. So I'm willing to give it a shot. Visually, it looks cool. Like I said, I
kind of had a thought before I saw The Green Knight. And I don't know necessarily where I placed The Green Knight in this, but I did kind of have a thought of, like, could it possibly be that the best King Arthur movie we have is Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail?
Well, first
off, which is the most removed from actual Arthurian legend out of all of them.
You're disrespecting the Clive Owen movie.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Of course.
I love that.
Movie is that?
The Clive Owen King Arthur movie with Keira Knightley and Clive Owen. Joel Edgerton's in it. Hugh Dancy. Oh, no. Yeah. It's pretty.
Joel Edgerton. Alex is gone.
Yep.
I don't get the hate on Joel Edgerton, but I think that's a podcast for another day. I feel like that's a TED talk I have to listen to from Alex, not a podcast.
I'll come on socially distanced one day, and we'll just do a whole
Alex, I want you to have like a glass of wine and come on and be like, here's why I don't like Joel Edgerton, by Alex Marks, and just go.
In this essay, I will.
I could definitely do that, trust me. So
I don't doubt it. Well, we have spent quite a bit talking about what we've been watching recently, so I think it was smart for us to just stick to a discussion of our featured review, which we will now be getting into, which is The Suicide Squad, and it is written and directed by James Gunn, who, of course, is responsible for the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. He, of course, did Slither and Super, two films that I would highly recommend to people if they haven't seen them already. This is a DC film with some returning characters from a film which we will not name from 5 years ago, as well as some new characters. And I want to start off just by asking what you guys thought. Bill, let's start with you, since I have not heard your podcast yet that you did with Alex about this movie. What did you think of The Suicide Squad?
Well, I mean, anything had to be better than the first one. And lo and behold, this one was exponentially better. I really liked this movie. To me, I was, it seemed like, and I don't think I'm breaking any ground by saying this, it was just like, they're like, hey, can you just make like a hard R-rated Guardians of the Galaxy with some like really D, E, F, and G list DC characters and just make like a fun movie and make everyone forget the old movie? And James Gunn's like, sold, I'll do it. And that's exactly what we got. I thought it was just it's a fun movie to watch. It's very funny. I had just a great time watching this film. It was one of my top movies of the summer because it's just like, some of the violence is just very stunning. Like the scene where King Shark gloriously rips a man in half basked in the rain. I thought I think that should be that scene should be saved by the American Film Institute. They should recognize the national treasure that it
put it right next to the original copy of Mr. Stewart goes to Washington.
Mr. Smith goes to Washington, played by Jimmy Stewart.
I was grasping for the name there.
I just thought it was. It's just a really good. It's just. I would love to see what a James Gunn. You know, I want to see more James Gunn in the DC universe. I want to see him in that sandbox because it seems like it's a lot of fun. Because that's a word that I don't feel like DC films really are described as, because they try to be so, a lot of them try to be so serious and so dour and so our lore is so goddamn important, and you're just like, okay guys, like, let's have a little fun.
But they really try to go hard in let's make Zack Snyder do a different version of the Avengers. They went really hard on that. They were banking on it and it didn't work. Like, well, that was the mistake. They committed to a direction that was not good to commit to.
You're putting this out on audio form right now, so I hope you enjoy the rest of your life being doxxed by those fans by saying that it wasn't.
Oh, they can come at me.
Oh, no.
I'll take it.
So many mad boys are going to come after you.
Noah has spent the last year writing a better version of the most recent Star Wars movie. So
yes.
If the fans are going to come at him, those fans already have a target on his back.
Emphasis on boys.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
The boys, and I won't even put a Z at the end because they would at least make them cool. But yeah, this is just... a lot of fun. Yeah, sorry, my oldness kicked in there for a second. I remember the 90s. But yeah, this was a fun movie, and I was surprised by a lot of the performances in it, particularly John Cena, who obviously I've known about John Cena before he was a famous pro wrestler, because the first time he was ever on TV was like this TLC documentary about independent wrestling. And I'm like, oh, that guy could be something. And then lo and behold, he is now the Peacemaker. So I've been following his career for like 20 plus years. And to see him in this role, which was so foul-mouthed and so violent, and yet he worked so well in it. And now we're getting this spinoff series from it. I'm all for it. And I think that series is going to do really well, because obviously Peacemaker is one of the standout characters from the show.
That's right, because his public persona has kind of been, oh, he's huge and hulking, but he's so sweet.
His TV presence is constantly like, I'm on the Nickelodeon Kids Choice Awards, look at me, I'm like super PG. Even in wrestling he was like, yeah, I'm super PG and family friendly. And like his movie roles suggest very much otherwise, from if you saw Sisters or Trainwreck. If you're gonna watch one of those movies, watch Sisters. I did not like Trainwreck.
Ooh, all right.
Yeah, that movie.
Blockers is a really good movie.
Blockers is good too. Like he's always in R-rated kind of raunchy comedies, or not always raunchy comedies, but I'd say R-rated, where he gets to lean into more stuff, I guess. So
he was also in that movie where he played like a fireman or something, and there was like a bunch of kids and a dog and Keegan-Michael Key.
Yeah, I don't.
Clifford the Big Red Dog?
No. that movie trailer looks like an antidepressant commercial has been.
I once had a dog and its name was Depression.
Someone actually colored it purple and had him fall around, just like fly you anywhere. And I was like, yep, it will. But like to see him here, not just to be in a very small part like he was in Sisters or even in Trainwreck, he's got this leading role where he can just keep that, you know, turn that macho thing on his head and then just like lean into it so hard, which is something you don't think about when you think of his public persona. It's like, it was like really, really impressive. And I'm very excited the fact they were giving him a show and they're really, you know, banking on this character, because I think his performance really led to that. He's the breakout character, not in the same like level as Harley Quinn, but he is he's the breakout character from this movie. That and King Shark, which like if we don't get a King Shark series, like, I don't know why this world is even existing at this point.
Yeah, no, I think Harley Quinn remains probably the biggest win so far for the DC extended universe, if we can still call it that. And that's almost exclusively thanks to Margot Robbie, who is just taken it and worked it for all it's worth at this point.
Oh, 100%. And her scenes in this movie were phenomenal.
I really dug the bait and switch we get with Harley Quinn and with the first of the would-be dictators.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Just before we get into that, what did you think, like, in general, Noah, about?
So my first two thoughts were, League's better than the first one. And the second thought was, and this might be surprising, more restrained than I expected. When everyone was like, oh, James Gunn is going to get to go off the rails, I was expecting the movie at some point to make me very fundamentally, like, uncomfortable or nauseous. But it didn't. I mean, maybe that just says more about how desensitized I am.
They, like, brutally massacre an entire village filled with freedom fighters. Like, there's stuff there that could make you feel nauseous if you wanted to.
That's true. So maybe that's just me. but no, it was a lot of fun. This was very much what everyone kind of thought the first Suicide Squad was going to be. It's very much in the vein of what the original Suicide Squad trailer promised. I think that was a big part of the the first Suicide Squad trailer had an absolutely perfect trailer, and then the movie was not that trailer. So this was very much what we all initially thought we were going to get when they made the first Suicide Squad movie. And Gunn packs so much into it, and it's just fun from start to finish.
Oh, I agree. When you talked about the trailer, like, how they were, like, using the music so well to be like, wow, look at this fun, kind of like wild rock and roll type movie. And when you get to it, you're like, wow, this ain't it. And, like, they accomplished all of that. What was the promise of the first movie, they accomplished all that in that opening beach sequence. Like, that paid off on what we thought was going to be. It's just like, hey, here's this random Jim Carroll song, which most of you people don't know. And but it's going to be very on the nose about how everyone's going to die. All the people you know in the seat are going to die. And while TDK in his slowly moving arms, which is the greatest character in cinematic history, are like moving along to slap.
It's the DC version of Captain Hammer.
and so, like, they paid off on that trailer here in one scene. They paid off what that entire movie was the first movie was supposed to be in this one scene. And I thought, I'm just like, I don't think it was intentional, but, like, if it was, well played.
I have to say, the reaction of Margot Robbie and Joel Kinnaman to the detached arm scene is just solid gold right there. They both just look at each other like, what the fuck? Who thought this was a good idea?
Yeah, on our Socially Distanced episode podcast, we talked about the detachable kids so much that it ended up being the title of the episode.
We all fell in love with this character because it was just so beautifully ridiculous.
Yeah,
and only Nathan Fillion could have done it.
It's the perfect if you're only going to have him for one scene in your movie, that's the way to do it.
Absolutely.
Oh yeah, I have to say I feel a little bit bad for Will Smith getting his character basically redone, because Will Smith was not one of the bad parts of the first movie.
I don't think we should relitigate the first movie too much, but I will say that, like, he's not bad in the movie, but the movie doesn't know what to do with him, you know? So it's, like, shocking given the fact that he's Will Smith and he has so much charisma, and he's sharing scenes with Margot Robbie, who has so much charisma, how incredibly boring most of those scenes still are. And I think that Idris Elba is such a huge upgrade from Will Smith, and which is shocking to me. I said this on the Social Distance podcast as well, because I just find that incredibly surprising that, like, Will Smith is one of our biggest megawatt stars to exist in the world, and Idris Elba just, like, runs circles around him with basically the same character. Like, we should say Idris Elba plays Bloodsport, which is technically a different character from Deadshot, which is who Will Smith played, but they give him almost the exact same backstory and the exact same, like abilities, and basically the same character type and function in the group. So it's very clear that this was written for Will Smith, and, you know, the quote-unquote scheduling conflict, I think, was Will Smith has never been involved in a movie this like this. Like, he's never been involved in a movie this R-rated. He's been in R-rated films, but never really? This R-rated. And I think that he probably didn't want his brand associated with something. Really? Yeah.
Interesting.
Yes.
Would not shock me.
Yeah. Okay, and I think people like... Yeah, and I mean, that's not, he has not come out and said that explicitly, because I think that he didn't want to, like, you know, shit on anybody's stuff. Yeah,
CinemaJoes
know
the truth, Will.
There's just been...
Dare you to contradict us, Will. Dare you to retweet us, Will.
It feels not dissimilar to when he passed on starring in Django Unchained because of the violent content and... That like that part was written for him specifically. He was like, Quentin Tarantino courted him for a very long time, and he agreed to do it for a short period of time, and then he backed out because of that content concern. So I feel like once you watch a movie like this, you're like, okay, well, this is like way crazier, more violent, more politically incorrect, and also like political in general than Django Unchained was. So if he wasn't going to do that, I don't think he would do this.
Okay.
But I think we're kind of better for it, because Idris, this is like one of his better roles, honestly. Like, I mean, I love him in very serious stuff. I mean, his best role is always going to be The Wire. He's fantastic in this. He's funny when he needs to be. He's emotionally moving when he needs to be. He gets to have cool action scenes that he delivers on. He subverts the cool action stuff really well. He's just like 10 out of 10 great in this movie. So I think that we leveled up surprisingly.
I think what are your favorite Idris Elba moments in this movie? I think mine is his reaction to the end of his dick waving contest with John Cena. Well, when they're infiltrating that one camp and killing everyone.
When he's like, oh, it is cooler.
Yeah. It is cooler. Damn it.
Part of what I love about that character so much is that he is like very cocksure and very like, you know, assured in his abilities and everything. And yet at the same time, he's also like very reluctantly, but eventually like does learn from all the people. Like, you know, he does learn to adapt. He's not above like changing his way of thinking. And it comes through in that last moment with Peacemaker in a really satisfying way, which I should maybe say we are probably going to be getting into some spoilers. So
there's a Patrick Starfish kaiju. So there we go. We've got the big spoiler out of the way.
But yeah, it's so funny. It's like we're talking about, well, he learns how to adapt. His whole power is, his whole gimmick is he adapts weapons into things into other weapons.
Yeah,
but he never learned how to adapt his personality to be a person, to be a leader,
and, to be human, well, to be a father. Sort of.
But I think like my favorite moment for him was like the bus scene with Ratcatcher 2, because he basically just is like he has this fatherly moment, even though he's still like kind of grumpy and pissed off. He's just like. Basically, it's just like if there's one character, it almost seems like it's like if there's one person I need to get out of this mission, it's this kid. I have to get her out of here alive. It's like, I don't matter if like I have to get out or not, but she should. It almost feels like he's like, she should get out, because he like can see. I probably see some of his daughter in her, and he just realizes she has like one of the non messed up people in here, because she basically got caught for robbing. She was like a thief, you know. She wasn't a bloodthirsty, you know, mass murderer like everyone else,
or like the weasel, or a shark that eats people.
Well, that's what I was saying. You know, I lump that beautiful, you know, sea creature into mass murderer.
Yes, yeah, that's fair. Fair enough.
His name is Nanawe, so let's put some respect on his name.
Justin, what did you think about this movie?
I really enjoyed this. I almost had that as a foregone conclusion going in, though, and I didn't know if that was going to like make this a less satisfying experience for me, but I really just loved how this movie embraced being weird when it wanted to be. I love the fact that the whole climax of this revolves around a giant starfish kaiju, as you mentioned, Noah, and the fact that it's like all these ridiculous psychedelic colors. I just love that. It looks so goofy and I love it.
Giant eyeball right in the middle.
Yeah, it almost like this is a deep cut, but like it almost reminded me of the boss Krakko from the Kirby games, for any of my gamer fans out there. Anyway,
only hardcore gamers play Kirby.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Hey, I did, so you know that it's
hardcore. Gatekeeping.
But I also think the movie could be like really unabashedly sentimental when it wanted to be as well, which I appreciated, and something that I've seen now in the last few movies that Gunn has made. And it just is a nice balance, I feel like. And I think that just I think the action in this movie looks really good, which is really refreshing. I think that was maybe my biggest surprise. For some reason, I thought it was just going to be like total CGI bloat. And I feel like it actually does really effective things with CGI. It like has stakes, like everything looks really good.
It's got variety.
Yeah. And I also appreciated the, you know, maybe not so subtle anti-colonialist message here. It's, you know, I think it has a little bit of resonance in a way that I wasn't expecting for a film that is so goofy and silly in a lot of ways. I think it does at least reckon with some hard truths. And I think I did really appreciate some of the moments where you can sense that there's this sort of confused sense of morality. And characters have to make a choice and sort of reckon with the ironclad you know, decisions they've made about their own loyalties and about their own principles, which I, you know, will maybe become more clear as we talk about this. But yeah, I really enjoyed this. It was just fun, as we've been saying. Like, it's the kind of thing I kind of wish I had seen in a theater. But instead I saw The Green Knight in a theater, which was, say what you know, was great to see in a theater, but maybe not the kind of fun experience that that this film gave us. So that's kind of where I'm at with it.
All right.
And how about you, Alex?
I also didn't see this in a theater, and that didn't bother me at all, because this is a really fun movie. It's a super fun comic book movie. I watch a lot of comic book things at home, and that's okay. I think that the scale and the colors and the humor all comes across, even if you're watching it on a tiny screen in your house. I enjoyed this movie a lot, as I think you can tell by now. I was honestly a little bit surprised by how much I liked it, even though I am a fan of what Gunn has done in the past. But I just, you know, all of the sort of like, oh, it's going to be so gross and like whatever, like super violent and stuff. I like, that's never the thing that I like the best about anything that happens. So I was not entirely sure how I would take that stuff. And truly, I don't love that part of the movie as much, you know, like the gore and stuff is just not for me. But I feel like what Gunn does so well in this film is he has such a huge cast of characters to try to balance, and he somehow manages to make you care deeply about every character that he needs you to care about in the exact moment that he needs you to care about them. And that's kind of like a magic trick. I think it's really incredible that he could make you be so invested in all of these characters in exactly the moment that he wants you to be. It's sort of like a maestro playing a symphony. It's really impressive in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, that was the secret sauce for the Guardians of the Galaxy's movies, too. Like, I think that's the reason why those became so successful, even though there's, like, pretty much no one knows or knew those characters. You know?
Kind of loves the fact that you don't know who any of these people are, right? It's not like, oh, you've waited your whole life to see Blackguard on screen.
Yeah, you kind of got to play to see it. Yeah.
Instead, it's like, oh, these are a bunch of random weirdos who you have no idea who they are, and they're played by actors who you may or may not have a relationship with, and, like, we're gonna just go, and they do a great job. I love so many of the touches that he does. I really love the interstitials, the way that he uses the environments to spell out the words and stuff. That's, like, such a small detail that doesn't ultimately matter, but it adds to this, like, heightened reality and freneticism of the film that really works. And I just can't believe how much I cared about that damn giant starfish monster. Like, I really was so sad when he died. It was really upsetting. I was like, no, don't try to take over the city, Starro. You're a good person. It's like, you're a giant starfish space monster. You're not a person. But that's how I was like, no, please, come on. We can work this out. Like, it's not these people's fault. Don't go full villain. But it's like, I was really invested in all of these characters, and I really enjoyed myself for most of it. I thought it was interesting that they tried to do a little bit of American imperialism commentary. I think a smart filmmaker knows that you can't have a character like Amanda Waller without engaging with that sort of material, but I'm still surprised that they went there, and I think that they did an okay job. It's obviously kind of surface level, but for a movie like this, surface level is still pretty radical, and so I appreciated that. I think Alice Braga in a very small role was excellent as like the leader of the Freedom Fighters, and I wish I could have seen a little bit more of her. And if you've listened to our episode on Socially Distanced Podcast, you'll know that my favorite performer of the entire ensemble is, of course, Chris Pratt, who played Sebastian the Rat. That is Crisp Rat. It's the rat actor name. And he, along with his partner Jaws, who also sometimes played Sebastian the Rat. But I mean, we all know that Crisp Rat is the one that stole the scenes as Sebastian. So he was my favorite. I loved his little outfit. I was very, very worried when he went inside of the starfish monster, and I was very happy to see that he made it out on time. And it was Crisp Rat, and it was Margot Robbie and Idris Elba. They were the three stars of this movie for me. I mean, Ratcatcher 2 lady, she was good also, but she was nothing without Crisp Rat, who really kind of just like pulled her through the scenes and elevated her.
So I have a bone. I want to know if you guys are interested in picking this bone with me. So Amanda Waller. So we talked about the fact that this movie does get political. Like, it's not, it doesn't shy away from that. And we know that in real life, the, in air quotes, justice system and, you know, prison complex in the United States is very much designed in conjunction with a lot of state laws for the explicit purpose, particularly to target minorities, especially Black people, with, you know, maximum sentencing and throwing them into facilities that are basically designed to break, kill them. And we have a Black woman running one of these facilities, proudly boasting that they have the highest death rate of any prison in the United States, basically saying, yeah, we're going to make sure that a 16-year-old girl gets sent to us so that she can suffer and die, and uses that as leverage. I wonder if you guys think there's any incongruity, or if that's like a bad look on the film's part.
Well, just as a factual correction, she's not running the prison. She's running a special, like Black Ops mission inside of the federal government. I think that is important. She's the federal prison that she has access to is just a kind of perk of the job. And I think that's important difference. I think that the character of Amanda Waller is not problematic, because I think that it is part of that broader critique that the film is talking about in terms of the sort of corrupting nature of American imperialism. A person of color who would be able to rise to the level that they would need to inside of such a morally complicit system would have to be someone who is willing to go to the extremes that Amanda Waller is. I think that is her, the way that this movie indicts the system, I think lines up perfectly with the characterization of Amanda Waller. Okay. I think even better so than in the first movie, where she's just kind of like, they want to kind of split the difference in the first movie a little bit and make her be this sort of like ruthless hard ass, but also kind of a hero that you want to root for in a certain level. And it's like, no, this movie gets the fact that she has risen to the place of prominence that she has because she had to take on all of the worst aspects of this machine in order to get there. And that makes her a villain. And I think that is very apt. Okay. And I think that, you know, if you look at how other people of color or other minorities have to rise in systems that are very morally complicit, morally bankrupt, you see that same sort of trajectory in real life. You know, you think about, you know, not to be too political, but you think about prominent, minority people in political organizations that don't necessarily have the best interest of those minorities at heart, like thinking of, you know, one of the people who were the who created the push in the mid 2000s of the gay marriage bans on the Constitution was a gay Republican. Dick Cheney was factor in that. His daughter was a gay Republican. And so it's like, if you tie yourself to these things, you cannot you cannot protect that part of yourself. You have to get indicted by it as well. So I think that that is actually part of the critique and in a very insightful way.
I think that makes sense. I was curious to see what you guys thought of that aspect of the film.
And I don't think that it was a mistake that, like, when, like, I think that, you know, whether this matters or not, the person who takes her out out of all the people in her crew is another Black woman. And I think that that was meaningful, that that was.
OK, that's true.
I do appreciate, not that this is going to add anything to the conversation, that New Girl alum Steve Agee was the other guy there. Because if people don't remember him from New Girl, he was the I think his name was like Outdoor Steve or something like that. He was the homeless guy. And like seeing him there, I was just like, ah, I'll just always be in roles like this. You beautiful bearded man.
He's a James Gunn regular. Like, he's played one of the Ravagers in the Guardians movies. And he also did the motion capture for King Shark. So he's a very talented gentleman.
Wow. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Right, so I think it's time that we move over to the true hero of the movie. And that I'm referring, of course, to David Dastmalchian. Or Dastmalchian. How is that pronounced?
It's, you know,
Dastmalchian.
I'm positive that you're saying it wrong, but I don't know how to say it correctly. So let's just move on. Dave, our friend Dave.
Dave, our friend Dave, who plays the true hero, the polka dot man. I loved this bit about him and his mother. Those for me were some of the best comedic drops in this entire movie. When it reveals that, like, psychologically he sees everyone and everything with his mother's face. And we get this backstory about his mother is kind of an evil scientist, basically, who, like, tortured and infected her children for the purpose of, like, creating a superhero. And you're like, wow, I wonder what sort of person would do that. And then when you see, like, the image of who she is, it's like just some doughy suburban, like, middle-aged housewife, basically.
Yeah, the actress is Lynn Ash. She is really great. I think that she does a really nice job.
And it's just, it is not the image that you would assume. Like, if you just hear the description, like, woman tortures and infects her children, that's not the image that most people would have. But then to see it superimposed and everything, like in the club scene, where he's dancing with all these, like, women around him, and they all have his mother's face. It's just like, there's some weird psychosexual stuff going on here.
The best line in the whole movie is when he exclaims right before he tragically leaves this mortal coil is, I'm a motherfucking superhero. And that can be taken so many ways. And I sat there and I'm just like, James Gunn, you sadistic son of a bitch.
Yeah, I feel like they slid that one in underneath DC. I don't think that DC's people really understood the full implications of what that was. Nope.
But he's so great. I mean, he's been that guy who's just, you see him in a million things. I remember him being
you see him and you're like, I know that face. I've seen that face, but I can't place it.
Well, he definitely had the first time I remember seeing him was The Dark Knight. I remember that. And I want to say Dark Knight Rises as well. But yeah, he's just been this character actor for years, and just putting him in this role, he was utterly perfect for this very bizarre deep cut character that became, you know, and that, like Alex, like you were saying, he just, James Gunn just has this way of making us care about all these characters so wonderfully at the same time, because we find you, even though it's a very messed up line, you're like, yes, you finally did it, you son of a bitch. And then I'm like, this is great for him. And then I'm like, oh wait, this is like the second before he died. There, he's dead now. And and it's just like, he makes us care. You know, and I think the fact that he has this ridiculous power that you're like, why is this guy important? Then it's just like, oh no, he's actually the most effective member of the team because his polka dots essentially disintegrate things and people. It's pretty rad that they could do stuff like that.
Another one of the best comedy drops. What happened to all my men? I turned them into my mother and my mind and killed them.
Yeah, he's great. I really like him. I really like everybody, honestly. Joel Kinnaman in the first movie was so boring, and like, and he's so great here. It's just everyone is used so perfectly. Like that he had to find one obnoxious person who will just immediately die in a way that you'll be very happy to, and they cast Pete Davidson, and that was just like perfect casting. Yep. Everyone in this movie is so well used. And I just think that that's a real high wire act, and I'm just very surprised by how strong they've been able to do it. I mean, we haven't even talked about Peter Capaldi yet, who is just excellent as the Thinker.
Oh, so fun.
Just a fucking gross weirdo, man. Like, oh man, what a fucked up dude he is.
I love how they don't even bother to explain how these nods on his head work, or even how they're exactly how they're attached to him. They're just there. You just got to accept it.
Well, and also that, like, no one else really seems to mind or notice it, really. It's just like, yeah, I mean, this is a fucking weird world that we live in.
Isn't he wearing, like, a jumper? He just wanders into, like, a regular... for a lot of it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's great in this because, like, if you only know him from Doctor Who, he's just, like, he's so acerbic in this, and he's so just cutting, and I think people don't realize how great he was because.
Well, my introduction to him was in The Loop.
Well, I was going to bring
that up. Yeah, that is exactly it's the exact same character.
Yeah.
Yeah. On not to keep talking about socially distanced, but if you want to listen to us talk at length about his role as Malcolm Tucker in The Loop and the Thick of It, that definitely came up for about 10 minutes on that podcast.
Oh, awesome. Great movie.
Love both of those things.
Yeah. But yeah, and I do, I mean, I was a little bit flip about Daniela Melchiori, but she's really, really great as Matt Ratcatcher 2.
I like that
she's called Ratcatcher 2 also, like that it's just like, because like that's such a comic booky thing, but like you have, even when they do that in movies, like they don't literally do like, just call them the second one, like that's so silly, but it's so good. And her like flashback where she's in like a little like twisted version of like Oliver Twist or something, like with her dad played by Taika Waititi, and it's just like so romantic, but they're in the sewers in Paris or whatever. I don't know, it's so wild, it's so crazy, it's probably really Lisbon. Really fun.
Well, she said she was Portuguese, so it would have to be Lisbon.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, but it doesn't have to be Lisbon, that scene, but that makes sense.
Throwing that scene in there, like in the height of all that like chaos and destruction, to throw this like little scene of them on top of a statue, right, together as father and daughter, like was such a it on paper. I'm sure if you read that, it would be a very odd choice, but when it plays out on screen, it's just such a wonderful little scene, like to break everything up and just to like we were saying before, like with James Gunn, how he could have these nice sentimental moments and they feel earned and real. And I thought that was a really cool moment.
Yeah. And I want to also just talk a little bit more about how great Margot Robbie is as Harley Quinn. Like this is now the third instance that we've seen of her. And I just think she's extraordinary in this role. I think she does such a great job balancing the heart and the humor and the sort of mental disturbance at the center of this character. I think that the movie kind of has to bend over backwards pacing wise to justify giving her a spotlight. But I don't mind because I think it's just such great use of our time, that interlude with her and the dictator and the birds, and you know, and then like I was a little bit worried at first when all that happened because I thought like, oh no, are they just gonna make her be this guy's girlfriend so that way we can learn more about him for a while? That's really shitty. And then like, no, she just fucking kills him immediately.
Yeah, no, like she is like slow burn giving this character a long term like arc with character development over three very disparate movies. I mean, this movie is much closer spiritually to Birds of Prey than it is to First Series, but they're still very different movies made by different people. But she is like, she has found, I think she has clearly found what works for this character. And if I'm the people running this movie franchise, I would say just from now, whatever Margot Robbie says, do this, do that with the character, shut up and listen, do what she says. Don't second guess it. Just let her work her magic with this.
Yeah.
Taking this, I think that's the one character in these movies that people do have like a past association with, because Harley Quinn, has been like has really grown as part of the Batman universe. So that's the one character in these two movies that I think most people would know coming in.
Yeah, well, and Amanda Waller, who's a pretty big
deal
in the DC universe.
But like even popularly, like people know, people have heard, like even people who are not into comics have heard of Harley Quinn.
Yeah, because well, if they've walked into Hot Topic in the last 20 years, they've heard of her.
Well, yes. So it's no, it's I'm so happy. It's always cool whenever this happens when a really good performer gets their claws into this role and just and you can tell okay they get it, they know what they're doing, and as long as they're willing to do this role, we're in for some fun times.
Yeah,
it's true. Like I love her dress, the red dress that she wears for most of this movie. Mm-hmm. I love her whole thing with the javelin. It's such a fun running bit that like really pays off multiple times in a great way. I love how capable she is presented as being, like when it's like in the torture scene, when it feels like a sort of like R-rated flip on the Black Widow scene from the Avengers, where it's like the guy thinks that he's totally in charge and in command, and then as soon as she wants to get out and just murder everybody she can without any issue, you know, like and there is a way where that feels cheap, but she sells it so effectively that it doesn't. It feels really earned for the character to just be like, I'm not gonna be victimized by these fucking men anymore. Like, I'm gonna kill all of them if I have to. And then like the way that scene is presented with the flowers and the music and everything is just so interesting. And it's just like when that was happening, I was like, okay, I'm completely in whatever this movie is gonna give me from that point on. But you know, Justin, I'm curious how this Margot Robbie Harley Quinn stuff worked for you, because you haven't really gotten a chance to say.
Right, because you mentioned the one, like your initial fears of like the scene with the dictator, and like, oh, is this gonna be one of those moments in a movie where we're just learning about this other character? And I feel like the moment when they said like, okay, we're gonna go rescue Harley, and she's, you know, basically like chained to the ceiling, I'm like, oh no, like now she's like basically playing the damsel. Like I had it in my head, I'm like, oh, this is a thing we've seen in so many movies and it's gonna play out in that way, really? And then when it was happening and you realize, like, I actually, like, throughout that whole action scene, which I found really visually striking pretty much from beginning to end, it's almost balletic. And there's one particular scene of her
literally
just like
balletic.
Yeah, like where she's just like, you know, firing these guns, and you know, you get this like aerial view of her spinning around like a helicopter. And but what throughout that whole scene, like, oh, okay, like at some point she's gonna get overwhelmed, and you know, and then like the Suicide Squad's gonna show up and like, you know, kind of finish up business. And it just kept going, and it just kind of like held me in suspense the whole time because of that. And then she just like goes out a door and is like on the street. And I just thought it was, there's a lot of ways in which this film is like undercutting our expectations and, you know, subverting them in very satisfying ways. And
well, the trailer did give that away, though.
Yeah.
That is.
Oh, okay. I did not watch the trailer, so that was a surprise to me. Okay. I think that's really stupid. Yeah. It was in the trailer. But,
no, sort of like how one of the Green Knight trailers gave away the ghost that the fox talks eventually. It's like, you know, might want to say, should have saved that.
Also,
yeah,
like
the trailer beat that is the beats that given away in the trailer is just like the scene where she runs into Idris Elba and he's like, wait, we are here to save you. And he's like, oh, well, we could. And she's like, oh, that's so sweet. I could go back in if you want, like that little comedic beat at the end. That's in the trailer.
Yeah, that felt very genuine in the moment. And I thought that was really touching. And I think speaks to this bigger theme, I think, in the film about making friends amongst the people that you have. Like these. There's one line. Let's see. I think I wrote it down here. There's one line that one exchange between Harley and Bloodsport, where after Rick Flag has died and Harley says, Flag was my friend, and Bloodsport says, mine too, and I haven't got many of those. And it's almost like you're kind of picking up what you can from the people that you're surrounded with given your circumstances. And I thought that was a really touching moment of that.
I think now's a good time to mention the true MVP of this film, Milton, who tragically was lost.
Yeah.
The best
one. I have to say, it did occur to me. I did keep seeing, I'm like, okay, he's sticking around. He's sticking around. I wonder what they're building to here. And then we find out. another low-key hilarious moment, the Harley Quinn perspective shot when she sees them going to rescue her, and you see Idris Elba with his like Bloodsport mask on, like trying to sneak across unseen a street. And it's very subtle, but it's, yeah. I love, there's so many moments like that in the movie.
Yeah, these people could not be more conspicuous in their covert operation.
He has this death mask. He's like, tiptoeing across the street.
I need to ask, and I don't know if you guys brought this up on the Socially Distanced podcast, but is Bloodsport's mask meant to look like a xenomorph, or is that just my wishful thinking?
Oh, that didn't occur to me. We definitely didn't talk about his mask on that podcast.
It's more like, I thought it was more like, what's his face, his mask? Let's say Slade. I don't know, what's that guy's name?
From Teen Titans. That's a good comp, actually. That's a very good comparison.
I didn't want to say, Deathstroke, yeah.
And now I want to go rewatch Teen Titans.
Teen Titans Go is great.
Do they use Deathstroke on Teen Titans Go? That feels a little inappropriate.
I think he's been on there and not murdering people, but yeah, that's Slade was the first thing I thought of. So I'm like, okay, is he part of his team or something? I was a good, you know, journalist and like did any sort of research and looked into it. But I was just like, oh, I wonder if they were like, this, they're both mercenaries, same unit, same team type deal. That's the vibe I got from there.
Yeah, I'm looking at the helmet again, and I don't think it's meant to be a xenomorph, but I can see why I thought that, because you got the lack of eyes and the very prominent teeth.
I think it's more supposed to be like a dark, like, subversion of like the Iron Man helmet, right? Like,
ooh.
Given his role on the squad and everything, you know, and the way that it's all like nanotech, just like Iron Man uses the nanotech, but just like, you know, maybe a more honest version of what Iron Man would be.
Iron Man,
it is super cool.
But yeah, so I had one question for everyone before we end. And Bill, this is a different question than my final question on our podcast together. That is, are you guys going to watch the Peacemaker show that comes out next year?
100%. Like, okay. Absolutely. You're going to give me foul mouth, murderous John Cena, who will eat a beach full of dicks and murder man and woman alive.
Who knows why Mad Men do what they do.
For the sake of peace. And you're going to give me the homeless guy from New Girl and the other office person. You're going to give those as regulars in the series. I'm in. I think it's going to be, I don't know how many episodes they filmed. I know it's already done and shot.
I think it's like a 6-episode show.
Which I think is perfect. And yeah, I will 100% be on board for that.
I just looked it up. I knew about this show. I didn't realize that like James Gunn was behind it. So yeah. That definitely makes me a lot more interested. I will say, I felt I liked John Cena a lot in this movie, but I felt like it was nice to see him balanced out by a lot of the other characters. The having to watch a whole show centered around him seems maybe not as appealing to me. But I would wait to maybe withhold judgment and kind of see how it pans out.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm going to echo what Justin says there. A lot of why I really love John Cena in this movie is how he bounces off the other characters, especially Idris Elba. Their dynamic is something special. I'm low level skeptical that I would be into a show with just him, his perspective, unless they come up with like a colorful other characters for him to bounce off of. I would wait and see. I think if the buzz is good, then I would probably give it a shot.
Apparently, Peacemaker's father will be in this one, played by Robert Patrick of Terminator 2 fame.
You're telling me it's a Marine reunion?
God, one can only hope. Daniel Brooks from Orange is the New Black is going to be his co-lead.
Okay, well, she's great. I love her, and I love the idea of her being in a James Gunn thing. That seems like a fun combination.
Described by James Gunn as the co-lead of the series with a different political view from the Peacemakers.
Yeah, I would imagine. Oh.
Most people's are.
There's a reason he was in that jail.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch.
Probably many reasons.
Yeah, it's interesting, at least James Gunn's behind it.
I briefly, when we saw that someone had survived, I briefly hoped they were talking about Joel Kinnaman, but it wasn't to be, so.
No, that man's heart exploded. He is not coming back.
It's a toilet in his heart.
I know, it's whatever.
Yeah, as for me, I'm definitely skeptical about that project. I did not know Daniel Brooks was going to be in it. That makes me much more interested, I'll be honest. Because I think out of everyone on this podcast, I think I like John Cena the least. I find his comedic sensibility to be very grating. Even in things that I like that he is in, he's usually my least favorite part. He just has that vibe of, like, what a person who isn't funny but like is around other people who aren't funny, and then so they're like, oh, he's so funny, he yells really loud, and that's always really hilarious. It's like, you know, it's like, I don't really think that he is actually a funny person. I think he's like a dumb person's version of a funny person, and so it's frustrating to me that he keeps getting cast in all of these comedic roles that would be better suited to an actual comedian. Like, I mean, Dave Bautista is another actor who started out as a wrestler, and I think he is genuinely very funny and is great comedic timing and knows how to play something big and play something small. John Cena is just always doing like 11 in a, and like isn't it funny because I'm talking like this? Like, I don't know, he just bothers me. But I think that he's well utilized here because he is consistently put in low status positions, which is really funny for a guy like him to be forced into these low status positions by his cast members. And I think that made him well utilized. I worry that they would be able to maintain that on a television show where he is the star. But I would watch the first episode probably, especially now that I know Daniel Brooks is there.
You've just described my complaint of John Cena for the last 20 years of watching wrestling.
Oh, cool. Okay. I'm glad you agree with me then. I was worried that you would be offended by that comment.
Oh, not at all. I watch so many John Cena things, and I'm just like, why is everyone telling me he's so good? I mean, yeah. He got better later, but like, I was like, I can't deal with it. But yeah, I totally see what you're saying, Alex. Like, he's like, you're taking a guy who was used in a role very nicely, and now you're making, instead of being a supporting player, he's the lead. How's that going to pan out? We've seen that happen in the past with other movies and TV series where, like, this really good supporting character is, like, shoved to the forefront and it doesn't always work.
Yeah. And it's 8 episodes, by the way, as a correction.
Yeah. Not 6. But still, I'm definitely going to give it a shot, especially with the cast that got around him. And Batista is better. He always has been.
The poster is, like, a cartoon version of Peacemaker's head, and it just says, fuck! The Peacemaker.
That's the name of the show.
That's definitely not running on primetime.
HBO Max.
Whenever you want to watch it.
Let's move on to plugs. It's really late. Yeah, I don't want to hold up Bill any longer.
Let me start with you, Bill. Where is the best place to find you?
If you must follow me on Twitter at Bodkinwrites, WRITES, where I am talking about wrestling, but most importantly, I am sharing the wonderful stuff that is on thepopbreak.com. Most recently, I'm extremely happy and proud of my team for interviewing the entire cast of the Star Series Heels, including Stephen Amell, who has been someone we'll get you guys an interview with him, and it just always seems to fall through. So we finally get Stephen Amell on the site, so I'm super stoked about that. Matt Wittes took care of all that. So go over, check out thepopbreak.com. We've got the whole cast, including Chris Bauer of True Blood fame, and Mary McCormick, who is in Plain Sight in The West Wing, former Pittsburgh Steel linebacker James Harrison, and Alexander Ludwig, who was in The Hunger Games, amongst other things. So yeah, we got the whole cast over there. Follow us on Twitter at The Pop Break. Follow us on Facebook /popbreak.com, all spelled out. We're on Instagram at The Pop Break. Going to be updating that soon as we are safely going back to concerts. Of course, I am the co-host of the Socially Distanced podcast, which you can find on Apple, Google, Anchor, and Spotify. We drop every single Friday. Myself and my co-host, Al Manarino, we talk about all the wonderful things in the world of pop culture. We just did our Suicide Squad guest with Alex Marcus, of course, and Alicia Weinberger. This week, we are going to be talking about the first two episodes of Disney Plus's What If, because we are unofficially, but we really desperately want to be sponsored by Disney Plus, since we seem to cover stuff from there all the time. And then we have a whole other number of podcasts that Alex has put together. You could check out the Pop Break TV Breakcast and The Winner Still Is and the Way Too Early Oscar podcast. Those can be found on Apple, Google, Anchor, and Spotify.
Very nice. Let's go to you next, Noah.
All right. Well, in addition to my work here in Cinema Joes, you can catch all of my written work on my blog at francenoir.blogspot.com. And you should also check out, as Justin said earlier, our Genesis-centered discography podcast, Pod on the Rooftops, which is also on thepopbreak.com.
Indeed. You can find me at thecinemaverick.com. That's my website. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick, where you can see what I've been watching. I've actually somewhat updated my letterbox, so I'm now current, I believe. I do have to add this movie, but then I'll be completely current. It's a real milestone for me. Anyway.
And then you'll stop watching movies, so that way it will remain
period. Yep. let's end with you, Alex.
Yeah, so you could follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. Over on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings, you can see over the past month I wrote reviews, short reviews, mostly about all of Wong Kar-wai's films. I watched his entire filmography for the first time. That was a really, really amazing experience, so definitely check that out over there. Also, over there you can find a list of every featured film that we have covered on the Cinema Joes podcast since 2017, when we first began with The Beauty and the Beast, the film that shall not be named as far as Noah is concerned. Also, you can follow our show at Cinema Joes on Twitter. That's a great place to find out when we are releasing podcasts. We try to do it every other Thursday, but sometimes life gets in the way. We also everyone, not just us on this podcast, can also find me on the first Wednesday of every month on Pop Break TV podcast feed for my podcast that I host with Bill Bodkin called TV Break. Last month, we were lucky enough to have Justin come on to talk about Masters of the Universe. Next month, we will be having our regular crew of Bill and Josh Cernacki talk all about, as we said, what was the show? Heels. Yeah. We're going to be talking about Heels, and we're going to be doing an Emmy preview as well. So that should be really fun. So check out all that stuff over there. As Bill said, you can subscribe to those podcasts in the individual podcast feed. You can also check out thepopbreak.com, click on the podcast tab and see all of the podcasts that have been recently released collected over there.
Wow. Yeah, and we do want to thank Bill for joining us today on this episode. It was a real pleasure, as always.
Thank you for having me. I made my yearly appearance last year, of course. Don't forget to check out my my appearance on Break, which was
an
episode. One of my podcast appearances ever.
Yeah, Point Break. Yes. You talking about Point Break was definitely a highlight of 2020. So thanks for doing that with us.
The bar is so low when you say that.
Well, we want to thank everyone who listens to us. We want to thank our subscribers. But for now, this has been Justin Mancini for the Cinema Joes, signing off.